first panel and witness is Lord Hall, former Director General of the BBC, and then with Lord Burt in the second panel, former Director General of the BBC, and then we're joined in the third panel by Tim Davey, the current Director General, and Richard Sharp, the current Chairman. Before I start, I'm just going to quickly go around the committee, see if there's any interest to declare. Giles Watling.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I'm an erstwhile employee of the BBC and sometimes in receipt of royalties.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Lord Hall, welcome back.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's been not too long a time since your last appearance before us. I wonder whether or not, without the benefit of hindsight, if you like, but consider what you knew at the time. Why did you report to the BBC Board of Governors that you believed that Mr. Bashir was an honest and honourable man?
Well, let me start off by saying, if I might, to acknowledge how hard this has been, the Lord Dice investigation for the royal family, for the two princes, and I'm sorry for the hurt caused. But at core here, I trusted a journalist. I gave him a second chance. We, the team, gave him a second chance. And that trust was abused and was misplaced. Let me say, I don't think the words honest and honourable, 25 years on, look appropriate at all. But let me give you some context. Uppermost in our minds then was, had the interview with Princess Diana, the decision that she made to be interviewed, been done fairly or not? That was absolutely uppermost in our mind. And the first investigation we did before Christmas under Tim Gardam talked to all people concerned and produced a letter where she said very, very clearly that she'd been shown no documents by Martin Bashir. She was not made aware of anything by Martin Bashir she didn't already know. And she had no regrets underlined by the interview. And it's quite interesting that Lord Dyson himself says that an interview of some sort would probably have taken place anyway. So at that point in our inquiries and our investigations, we came to an end. Tim Gardam, there was no case to answer. The second investigation was not, therefore, into had Princess Diana been misled into agreeing to the interview, but was the second issue, which was had the producer guidelines been breached, and particularly the producer guidelines on straight dealing. That investigation was under a separate team. There was continuity with Tim Souter, who was a managing editor, very excellent Tim Souter. And Sloman had come in as acting head from a very distinguished career as head of radio current affairs to look at all the arguments again. I took what I think is an unusual step of saying I would take part in the investigation and interview Bashir myself. Why? Because I had to establish whether I believed Bashir, whether I should therefore give him a yellow card or dismiss him. And that was what I was trying to work through. Now, in the end, we came to a judgment about his lack of experience, that he was out of his depth, that he was contrite, and we gave him a second chance. We trusted him, and it turns out we couldn't. So in that light, I understand why I was using words which actually, when you look at them now, just seem wrong. But it was me trying to work out, could I trust this man or not?
Okay. You very quickly sort of went through the first investigation, the one by Mr. Gardam. As head of programming, he, as I understand it, he actually wrote in his own handwriting a description of what Mr. Bashir had done, including creative fake documents. That was then sent to your office. What did you do as a subsequent to that? Was that, surely that is evidence enough, is it not? And that so really, to be honest with you, why on earth did you need to actually go into a second one? You should just basically have him in the office and said, did you fake documents? If the answer is yes, well, there's the door, get out.
So Tim Gardam left his report before he went off to Channel 4. At that point, I set up a fresh inquiry to look into what Martin Bashir had done with the documents, why he produced those documents. and to examine whether or not this was...
Were you aware at that point that he'd faked the documents? Because you've got the documentation to say that he'd faked the documents.
Yes.
You were aware.
We knew in December that he'd faked some documents. The difference between the inquiry in December...
How many documents being faked is acceptable to the BBC? Is it just one, or is it a plethora of documents? Because I'll be frank with you, and as a former BBC journalist myself, back in the midst of time in Italy, I'm almost speechless at the idea that anyone at the BBC could be found to have faked documents by a senior manager, that information then passed on to yourself, and then them not face instant dismissal. That is absolutely crazed. It's completely against the ethos of the BBC.
So what we did in the second inquiry was to examine why he'd faked those documents and where they'd been used, and his evidence for those documents. And what he told us at the time was that they were a collation of information he was gleaning. We told him, having had an hour and a half at least with him, when he ended up contrite and in tears, saying that he understood that he had made a mistake. Now, we then decided at that point there was a clear breach of those editorial guidelines on straight dealing with people who are prospective candidates for a programme. What he had done had not gone anywhere near air. If it had gone anywhere near air, that would have been an extremely serious offence. And we decided that we would give him a second chance because he was so contrite and because the guidelines on straight dealing, he understood the mistake he'd made. I then went on from there to ensure that as the new guidelines were being drawn up by the BBC, that the new guidelines that were drawn up by the BBC had very, very clear lines on the production of fake documents. Now, those fake documents then came out in the guidelines as, you know, being forbidden from then on. Those were not in the guidelines at that time, and they needed to be, and I made sure that they were.
But your response, you say those, to once you found out that he'd faked documents, was to set up another inquiry into the extent of the faking of documents, which, by the way, helped effectively trick a mentally vulnerable woman into giving a TV interview, which obviously we can debate whether or not that had further consequences, but that's the upshot of that. And your other response, though, was to effectively blackball the person who faked up the documents and then said that they had done so and come clean about it. Mr. Wiesler, where is the morality in any of this?
Well, when I look back at in hindsight...
It doesn't have to be in hindsight. It's a simple question. You can go and blackball someone all because effectively they've undertaken work that they then find out has been used for nefarious purposes, and then to have tea and sympathy with the person who's actually perpetrated all this. This isn't just a failure of management, it's a failure of morality.
Well, it wasn't my distress. Tea and sympathy with Martin Bashir, it absolutely was not. It was a very tough and hard interview. Mr. Wiesler was a freelance graphic designer. We were dealing with a very difficult and unhealthy programme culture. Steve Hewlett, the editor of the programme, who I trusted and still trust to manage the programme, made that absolutely clear. We'd had two inquiries into all the evidence around Martin Bashir when everybody had been spoken to. And in the heat of all that, I regret the language that we used about Mr. Wiesler, and also I think we could have managed that better.
Well, not just the language, it's the action. It's not just a question of language. It's basically putting someone's career on ice for no good reason whatsoever. In fact, for doing the right thing. I've got another question here just before I carry on with mine. From Steve Bryne on this particular issue. Bryne.
Yeah, Lord Hall, just very briefly on this issue, just looking back and following up on what the Chair's discussing. You know, I was once a very junior reporter at the BBC. I left before I became anything more. But this immediately after this interview, questions were raised about the way in which Mr. Bashir had secured the interview. And I just wonder, did it not raise any alarm bells when the scoop of the century, which this undoubtedly was, was granted to a very junior reporter at the time. I can't imagine that when I was working for BBC Radio Surrey as a junior reporter, as a young man, that I would have scooped an interview like this and BBC management would have said, good for Steve. But did it not raise any alarm bells at all that suddenly she agreed to this interview as to how he managed to secure it? It seems incredible not.
Well, I knew about the interview about a fortnight before it actually took place. The interview and Bashir was being managed by Steve Hewlett, the editor of the programme, who I trusted enormously. It was also being looked after by the controller of editorial policy, Richard Eyre, and it was also being looked after by Tim Gardam, the head of current affairs. News, by its very nature, is devolved. As you know, we have hours and hours of coverage each day. And your trust, therefore, into the teams that are actually pulling together programmes, or in this case, this interview, must be very strong. And I trusted Steve Hewlett, the editor of the programme, to manage Martin Bashir and the interview properly, as I did Richard Eyre, who's the controller of editorial policy, and Tim Gardam too. So it's based on trust. I went through the questions with Martin, well, not actually with Martin, but with the team of Hewlett and Eyre and so on. And I briefed the Director General about this because there was an issue around whether or not the chairman should be briefed, given that he was married to a lady in waiting for the Queen. But listen, on all of this, there was a very, very close relationship we had between the Director General right the way down to the programme editor. And that's that trust you have in each other's judgment and being honest with each other about what's going on is how you build programmes. It's how you, in this case, win an interview and make sure it's properly done.
So look, we get it all. We all understand that. But you're either very close to it or it was just devolved. Which was it? Are you seriously saying with an interview that was granted to a junior reporter with the wife to the heir to the throne that nobody questioned how that happened? Did it not cross your mind?
I'm so sorry.
Did that not cross your mind, Lord Hall?
Yes, we asked about, of course, about how it had come about. But of course we did. But I go back. You trust the team of Tim Gardam as head of programmes for current affairs, the editorial policy controller, and Steve Hewlett, the editor, who is sadly no longer with us because he would have a lot to say about this, I'm sure, to ensure that the interview was properly got and that it was also properly done, as indeed it was. I just make one other thing I just want to say on this as well. Lord Dyson is very, very clear in his report, quite high up in his report, that an interview would have happened anyway. Indeed, he mentions the fact that I think the Princess was going to meet with Nick Witchell at the end of August. That never took place because Steve Hewlett said, no, we're going to go down a route of Martin Bashir. So the context now we know was actually that an interview, according to Lord Dyson, was very, very likely. In this sense, Martin Bashir got it first.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve.
Let's turn to more recent matters, and for me personally a little bit more concerning, the rehiring of Mr. Bashir under your watch. I read with interest the report produced by the BBC yesterday regarding this, and for me it raises more questions than it actually answers. If I may, I'm going to put some of those questions to you as the person in charge at the time. At what point were you personally aware that Mr. Bashir had been rehired by the BBC, and what did you think of that given his history in the organisation?
I knew after the appointment had been made. I think what Mr. Macquarie said in his report, the BBC said in his report yesterday, was that Bashir was not rehired because of some sort of cover-up. He said that was entirely unfounded. And he said there was absolutely no evidence of me being involved, which there wasn't, in the appointment, prior to the appointment, and that's exactly the case.
Putting aside Mr. McQuarrie's supposition that it's entirely unfounded that Mr. Bashir was rehired in order to effectively keep him quiet, I wonder if you could, as the man in charge, you could comment on the process on rehiring, which I have to say I find utterly extraordinary. There were three internal candidates who were interviewed for the post and deemed unsuitable. The job was then advertised externally, and 18 CVs were received, but only Mr. Bashir's was selected from these external candidates. Now, I've spoken to the BBC, people at the BBC in the interim, and they've never heard of such a situation where only one candidate gets selected for what is a very expensive process in advertising externally. Can you shed any light for that at the committee of why it is that only one candidate from 18 was interviewed, and that one candidate was Mr. Bashir?
I can't shed any light on that because when you're running an organisation as big and as complex as the BBC...
Do you think that's right? Do you think it's right that? Do you think it's right that that was the case, that 18 CVs were received, but only one? I mean, presumably this wasn't like chances. It's pretty serious people who'd be applying for this, and only one person granted an interview.
I really can't comment on that. I mean, the person who's in charge of this, I think, is Jonathan Munro, the head of news gathering then, now deputy head of news. He would be able to amplify what the process was. I go back, Chair. I was running the organisation of 20,000 odd plus people. You can't be across every detail.
Yeah, but this is a known liar. This man's a known liar who's come back through your door. And even if you found out about it afterwards, you just didn't even think about inquiring how the process actually occurred, therefore.
Well, I go back. It's not for me to second-guess directors or people who are running large departments. I go back. You trust them. You trust them to make the judgments, to do all the soundings out that need to be done. I read in Mr. Macquarie's report that that Jonathan Munro had spoken to Steve Hewlett, the former editor of Panorama, someone whose judgment you would trust. But, you know, they came to their own decision about the rehiring of Martin Bashir. And as I say, it's also clear that if we knew then what we know now, then of course he wouldn't have been rehired.
Right. Okay, well, we'll take a word for that. 18 CVs received, so that's one element of this. Let's look at a further part of the rehiring process. As I understand it, internal candidate X, who had failed to make it through, was reintroduced into the process and joined by a candidate Z, another internal candidate, who later withdrew, which is quite interesting that they later withdrew, but anyway. So after the internal and external advertising campaign, Mr. Bashir only had to beat someone who had already been deemed to be unsuitable for the job. It was a complete charade on your watch. Now, I understand what you say about trusting people, but they badly let you down here by only interviewing one other person against Bashir, and that person had already been deemed unsuitable for the job.
Well, I understand that the then director of news, James Harding, didn't want to see more than two people. That's his prerogative. But I go back, I'm not going to second guess their judgment. He was running news, Jonathan Munro was running news gathering. Their judgment about the best person to fill that role was theirs.
Mr. Bashir to be given a series of what have been termed, and this is by people within the BBC, cappuccino interviews, a series of them, both before the job was advertised internally and then externally, and then during the hiring process. He was chivvied along throughout. And the process, I mean, a cynic would suggest, frankly, the process was entirely concocted in order to get the resolution at the end of the day that Mr. Bashir would get this job.
Looking at the report yesterday, and I can only read it as you can see no reason to say this was a shoe-in for Mr. Bashir reading the report. They were looking for the right person to do what is a very important job, and taking over from someone who had done a stunning job as religious affairs correspondent. A bit of context for you. We were at the time under some external pressure to improve our religious and ethics coverage, not just in news, but right across the BBC and radio and television. I asked James Pennell, who was then the director of radio, to look at that and to write a report for me on how we could improve our coverage. So I suppose that's a bit of context for you in terms of how...
So against this to improve your coverage on religious affairs, your answer was to employ a known liar?
That was not my answer. That was the...
The answer of your team. That's the answer of the BBC team, was to employ a known liar.
Well, they, as I say, according to the report that I read alongside you yesterday, processes were gone through. and they came to that conclusion. I'm not, and as I said to you, I'm not going to second guess my director of news on that.
Okay. How much is Mr. Bishop paid as first correspondent and as religious editor?
I can't answer that question either. I don't know.
Well, my information is it's likely to be £80,000 and £120,000. He was employed at 3 years after his rehire. We're talking over £250,000 in salary, even by conservative estimates. Were you aware of his output at the BBC at that time? What did he do for his money, is what I'm asking you.
I honestly, Chair, I'm sorry to be unhelpful, but I think these questions are better asked at the BBC, at the people who ran him at the
but
BBC.
But you were the DG. You were the DG. And also, frankly, you know, you can't be unaware that you come before a parliamentary select committee and you're going to be asked these questions. Well, look, I'll go a little bit further with this and see if you can provide any comment for me. He's employed for about 3 years, probably made about £250,000. We did a trawl through the BBC News website and also on BBC Output. We found that he basically appeared on air and on the website about half a dozen times during that time. It's about £40,000 a time. Quite nice work if you can get it, isn't it, Lord Hall?
Well, that's not an effective use of a correspondent. I would completely agree with you. That's not a good record, but you're telling me things, I'm afraid, Chair, I don't know.
Do you know why Mr. Bishop wasn't put on to a fixed contract as recommended by News, that he was just given the job? This known liar.
I'm really sorry to disappoint you in my answers on this, because I really don't know, and I think if you've run an organisation as large as the BBC, I go back to my point. You devolve responsibility for the hiring, for the terms and conditions, for the rates of pay, for the management of their output. You devolve that. And these are questions
okay,
that are
well,
best
one thing you may not have devolved. One thing you may not have devolved, because I found this absolutely extraordinary as well. And I know this sort of thing goes to Director General level. Okay. And that is basically why Mr. Bishir was allowed to moonlight for ITV whilst working as a BBC staff editor. Now, freelancers are allowed to work outside. Of course they are. That's the definition of freelancers. But to have a major news editor working for a rival network in his spare time, and it seemed he had a lot of spare time, didn't it? Isn't that an indication that, frankly, Mr. Bishir was just allowed to come and go as he pleased, he was given this wonderful sinecure, and then he was also effectively allowed to go and earn money elsewhere? And as DG, would you not be across the fact that a major news editor was working for the opposition on the quiet? Not on the quiet, sorry. With permission.
Well, not permission from me. And let me again say, these are judgments and issues you devolve to news management. And you have to ask those questions of the people who are running, or who were running Martin Bashir until recently. You know, the notion, Chair, that a decision about where Martin Bashir is deployed...
it's not deployed. That's a complete misrepresentation. That's a representation. It's not about deploying. You weren't deploying him. He was moonlighting. And what he did was he would have to have got permission to do that. And is it a religious affairs editor? That would have come across your desk or someone very senior in the organisation. So why was he allowed to do so?
Not across my desk, Chair, and I think that's a question for the then or current management of BBC News. I simply can't answer that, because how you, and I use the word deploy in its broadest sense, so I don't mean any way to suggest otherwise. You know, how he was used, where he went to, what he did, is a matter for news gathering management and not for the Director General.
Right, okay, so you would not imagine that, for example, let's say a really fine journalist like Laura Koonsberg, for instance, if she suddenly popped up on another network, that would not be a matter for the Director General then?
Well, I can't imagine for one moment that the news gathering operation would allow Laura Koonsberg to
exactly.
Do that.
So why was the religious affairs editor allowed? It is a position within the BBC.
I'm really sorry, but you have to ask the current
news gathering. Okay, that's fine. Government. We're getting absolutely nowhere. Alex Jones.
Thank you, Chair. Lord Hall, Lord Dyson has surmised that you were not entirely open-minded when you conducted your investigation into Martin Bashir in 1996. What do you make of that assertion?
So it's not true. I mean, the minute on which he bases that assertion, if I recall, goes on to say that I reported that the documents played no part in her decision to do the interview, that she'd written to us absolutely saying that. But let me just go back. The second investigation that we did under Anne Sloman, supervised by me, opened up all the lines again into Martin Bashir's behaviour. This was not a, let me stress, this was not an investigation we would do now because it was done within the line. It was done as you know, I think Lord Burt would have agreed, it was done within the management line to work out what to do about Martin Bashir. None of the people involved in that investigation were easy to either fool or close-minded. We weren't like that. Tim Gardam had left by that point, Tim Souter and Sloman. And John Burt himself is a journalist. So none of us were close-minded. We really weren't. One other bit of context for you. We've been brought in to reform standards at the BBC to bring order to BBC current affairs and news. We were not the sort of people who would be close-minded about things. And indeed, actually, John Burt himself, if he doesn't mind me saying so, I know he's on next, was unpopular for ensuring that standards were being maintained. So, you know, we were a group of people seeking after the truth. And could I also just say on my own sense, my own case, really, I came back into the BBC in the Savile crisis to sort out the BBC and its response to a real big crisis. I was open-minded. I wanted to get to the truth. My whole time as a public servant working for the BBC, 35 years, has been about integrity and ensuring getting the truth. I was open-minded in this. We'd had the letter from the princess, which we knew that the interview itself had not been got in some deceitful way. But we were not close-minded about the rest of what Bashir had done.
Okay. Why then were you so ready to accept Bashir's unsubstantiated claims, given that you knew that he had already lied at least three times?
Well, he'd lied about, when pressed very hard, about had he shown these documents to somebody else. And it was on the third time that he said he'd actually shown them to Earl Spencer. We believed, and Anne Sloman and I quizzed him really, really hard for an hour and a half, at which point he ended up, the thing I remember most vividly about this, he ended up in tears. We believed he'd been introduced to the Princess of Wales by Earl Spencer, that the documents he had made were from information from the Princess of Wales and Earl Spencer. We now, of course, know that's not the case. And that his documents were for a later programme. He saw Earl Spencer after he'd already, with the documents, after he'd already been introduced to the Princess of Wales. And he was putting together a file. So he appeared to us, and one of the difficulties looking back over 25 years is that he appeared to us at the time that he was contrite, that he was inexperienced, that he was out of his depth. And that's why, in the end, rather than sacking him, and I can see the reasons for that, we gave him a second chance.
Do you think it would have been different if the process had been part of a formal disciplinary hearing?
I think, well, we took a judgment then, and can I say, working really closely with the then Director General, because, as I said, we worked very closely as a team, to look at this in the line, as a management issue within the line. Had the guidelines been broken or not, and then what should the penalty for that be? When you look back at how you manage these sort of issues now, and remember, I came back into the BBC with the Savile crisis to look at a whole raft of issues around this, then I think you would come to a very different way 25 years on of running this. So you would take an issue like this and take it away from line managers and have an outsider looking at it. I think you would involve HR teams who now are much more used to doing these sort of inquiries. I think you'd have a very strong role for editorial policy. The BBC has an excellent director of editorial policy. I think they would have a role in this too. Now there's an independent complaints procedure, independent of the line, for people, you know, as Earl Spencer could then have raised a complaint independently of management. So I think the things that are now in place, we could have, you know, when you look back at it, you think, well, maybe we could have done some more of that than now. But of course, the whole problem with this is looking back from 25 years distance at what you did. And of course you think, well, we could have done something better. But nothing was done without us being trying to get to the truth and determined to be fair-minded
okay.
about it.
Okay, thank you, Lord Hall. In your answer there, do you agree with Lord Dyson and his conclusion that your investigation was woefully ineffective?
Well, I think the first investigation had established that the princess was not deceived into actually doing the interview. And Lord Dyson's very careful, I think, in his report to say that he doesn't question that. He does question the way in which Bashir got to the princess. The second investigation, we gave him, we gave Bashir a yellow card. We didn't get to the bottom of the lies that Bashir had told us. We weren't trying to conceal anything. I mean, I really do want to kind of stress that. But we were lied to, and our trust was misplaced. And you know, bluntly, Bashir took us all in, from the Director General down to the program editor, Steve Hewlett, someone who we trusted, you know, greatly.
Is it safe to say that you consciously decided not to approach Bill Spencer for fear what he might say?
No, it's not. I mean, our records show that Earl Spencer and Steve Hewlett, the editor of Panorama, no longer with us, actually did speak around the weekend of the Mail on Sunday story. That Earl Spencer briefed Steve on the draft statement he wanted to make to the Mail on Sunday, which seemed to say, according to Tim Gardam's record of the time, that Bashir had come with allegations about specific journalists, and that led him to introduce the princess, that introduced Bashir to the princess. Now, in the event, Earl Spencer made no comment at all. We thought wrongly that sort of dealt with the issue, looking back at it. And in fact, I accept Lord Dyson's recommendation that, of course, we should have, in the light of what Earl Spencer has said, of course we should have gone back to Earl Spencer, one of us should have done, to pin down exactly these facts about the fake documents. I accept that as a mistake 25 years on, but, you know, we were trying to do our best and be as rigorous as we could with what we had then, but we were confronted with someone who, in my 35 years at the BBC, I've not come across. You basically trust your reporters and your editors to tell the truth, and in this case, that trust was misplaced.
But Lord Hall, only seeking one side of a story wouldn't have been acceptable for a BBC journalist, so why was it acceptable for a senior manager at the BBC?
I think the focus of our second investigation was actually quite narrow, and it wasn't an inquiry, as I was suggesting to your other question, of the sort that we might have now into this. It was narrowly focused on what was the breach of editorial guidelines, and had Bashir knowingly breached them, and did he understand that he had breached them, and would he not do that again? And again, I say, these documents were used in front of Earl Spencer. He was shown them. That was an offence against the straight dealing guidelines, but the documents never went anywhere near air. I mean, that would have been an even more serious breach of the guidelines. So our judgment then was, it's about Bashir, and does he understand, is he remorseful? Does he understand that he's done something wrong? That's what we concentrated on. And it, you know, in retrospect, maybe the inquiry should have been bigger, but that's what we were trying to get an answer to.
Okay.
I'm sorry, my jaw just dropped there when you said about whether or not he was sorry or not. It's like, you know, this is the potentially has been described as one of the scoops of the century, and it's found to have been attained through, well, let's be honest about it, faking documents, fraudulent means, and you're more concerned about whether or not he's sorry or not. just absolutely priceless. Clive Efford.
Thank you, Chair. Lord Hall, Lord Dyson's report states that Martin Bashir does not seem to accept that he acted in breach of BBC guidelines. How many ways did he breach those guidelines?
He breached the guidelines in terms of straight dealing. He should not have put fake documents in front of Earl Spencer. We now know that because of Lord Dyson's inquiry, that there were other things that he did too. I frankly was astonished to read Lord Dyson's report saying that Martin Bashir hadn't understood the gravity of what he had done, because certainly to me and to Anne Sloman, he understood the gravity of what he had done.
So produced fake documents in a peculiar way as well. We didn't take that through any of his senior management. He made a visit to Mr. Veasler's home, which led him to be concerned about whether this was going through the proper procedure. And then later on, he lied on at least, according to Lord Dyson, at least three occasions to the BBC. So he breached the guidelines pretty much all the way through. So how did you come to the conclusion that he was an honest individual?
As I said earlier on, I think to the chair, I regret the use of those words now, but I go back to the interview that Anne Sloman and I conducted with him 25 years ago for over an hour and a half, and we pushed him really, really hard on the guidelines and his breach of the guidelines on straight dealing, and he was contrite. We thought he was out of his depth, and that's why we did two things. One is to ensure that he was properly and carefully and closely managed going forward by Steve Hewlett, the editor of the programme, who, as I say, we trusted hugely, and I still trust, and I wish he was here to talk more about this, but alas, he's not. And
yeah, the second but you're repeating yourself. Can I just get back to it? I mean, in that room, you could have been, you could have put him under a spotlight, stabbed him with a cattle prod. But the fact is that there were all of these breaches of the guidelines. There was the way he formulated, got those documents made. There was the lies that he repeated when he was questioned about it. There was the fact he used the fake documents in order to gain access to the Princess of Wales and get that interview. All of that surely must have added up to you to a serious breach. I think the Prime Minister got sacked for less when he was working for the Telegraph. So, I mean, how is it that you came to the conclusion that he was an honest and honourable man?
It was a breach of the guidelines. There was absolutely no doubt about that. The decision we had to make, and it's a decision lots of managers have to make in all sorts of different places, is if someone breaches the guidelines, it's the first time they've done it, do you say, that's it, farewell, you're sacked? Or do you say, all right, you're remorseful, you understand it, we'll give you a second chance? And that's what we did. And we did it having listened to him, having talked to him 25 years ago. Now, in the light of what I now know about Bashir, was that the wrong judgment? Well, yes, it was. But we trusted him, and we clearly shouldn't have done it.
Okay, I say just a failure to just acknowledge the facts that were in front of you. So can I just take you back to something you said to the chair at the beginning of the meeting, you said that you produced guidelines on how to produce fake documents. Is that what you really meant?
No, I'm so sorry. If that's how it appeared, that's not really what I meant. So there were two consequences to this, and I won't repeat one of them, but it was to do with management of Bashir. The second one was we were in the middle of revising our editorial guidelines, and I ensured that the controller of editorial policy then, Richard Eyre, amended the guidelines to include some paragraphs on the faking of documents to make sure that it was clear that this was not acceptable. That was not in the guidelines at that time.
So the BBC organisation needs guidelines to its reporters to tell them not to produce false documents?
The guidelines are there to tell reporters, producers, to act as the wisdom of how to conduct themselves across all the things that they're doing. And they're an important set of documents. In fact, before I left the BBC 9-10 months ago, I got a new set of guidelines which reflects where we were then on terms of editorial policy to be published and to go around to the staff.
Do you in hindsight that Mr. Weaver should have been treated as a whistleblower? I know legislation may have followed on from that regarding whistleblowers, but shouldn't he have been treated more in that way by the BBC, and shouldn't they have been grateful for him coming forward with his concerns about those documents and how they might have been used?
I think that's right. I think some context. There had been two investigations when everybody had been spoken to, first of all under the Gardam investigations, secondly under the Sloman investigations. There was a difficult programme culture that Steve Hewlett was dealing with, but I absolutely accept the point that Mr. Weisler should have been spoken to and listened to as what we would now see as a whistleblower. But he was listened. That's the point. He was listened to both by Tim Gardam and again in the second investigation. I understand, but I already said what I feel about the treatment of Mr. Weisler, and I'm sorry for the language. I regret the language we used.
And there doesn't seem to have been a satisfactory explanation from Martin Bashir as to why he had these false statements. Bank statements made up. But couldn't it have been, and did it ever cross your mind, that given that Earl Spencer and the Princess of Wales were concerned that they may be being conspired against, that these documents could be used just to feed that theory in order to obtain that interview? And did it ever cross your mind that that's why they were produced? Because it was peculiar to go so far to confirm what they believe to be facts of information that had been supplied to Martin Bashir?
So the timeline we were working on, which Martin Bashir told us, and remember, you know, we were talking all the time to people like Steve Hewlett, the editor of the programme, who worked closely, supervised Martin Bashir, was that he'd been introduced to the princess by Earl Spencer, and that the documents he had drawn up came from information gained from the Princess of Wales, that actually he then took those later, having been introduced to the Princess of Wales, to Earl Spencer. Now, we now know that timeline was wrong because of the very strong evidence that Earl Spencer has come up with. But at the time, we were lied to about that as well.
Yes, but what amazes me is that both at the time of Martin Bashir and also the time of his reappointment to the BBC, that there are all these top journalists have a remarkable amnesia when it comes to remembering the facts around what they did and didn't know about Martin Bashir. For instance, is it likely that these journalists that interviewed Martin Bashir about being employed in the BBC knew nothing of the scandal that surrounded Martin Bashir when he was employed at the BBC previously? Seriously, is that likely?
What I understand from the report that I read yesterday from the BBC is that the head of news gathering had spoken to Steve Hewlett, the former editor of Panorama, and had been briefed by him, and then the judgments about Martin Bashir's re-employment were made by him and by James Harding. So, you know, in that sense, that was his due diligence.
Well, let's just go to the conclusion of the BBC's report into the re-employment of Martin Bashir that was published yesterday. And right at the end, it says that I have no doubt that if any of the individuals involved in the appointment of Martin Bashir in 2016 have been aware of what is now publicly known as a result of the Dyson report, Martin Bashir would not have been reappointed to the BBC. But you did know. You'd done the inquiry. You knew he'd lied to the BBC on several occasions. You knew he'd produced that false document. You knew he'd used those false documents and shown them. Well, he'd certainly shown them to individuals. Yet you allowed him to be re-employed back into the BBC. And is it likely, and before you come back and say you didn't know, because it's remarkable how much people in the BBC don't know about very important decisions, but is it likely that when they were about to appoint Martin Bashir to such a sensitive position back in the BBC, that no one knocked on your door and said, we're about to re-employ Martin Bashir, or we are interviewing Martin Bashir? No one did that.
Well, they didn't. And to go back, my own view is exactly the view contained in the Macquarie report that you were reading from just then, which is we didn't know 25 years ago the scale of what Martin Bashir had done to gain access to the Princess of Wales through Earl Spencer. So you go back to the fact we didn't know 25 years ago what we know now. And if we knew now, through Lord Dyson, what we know about Martin Bashir, then of course he wouldn't have been re-employed. That's my view.
OK. I'll look at you.
Thank you. Kevin Brennan.
Allegations against Martin Bashir at the time that were made in the press of public interest, in your view?
I'm so sorry, I missed the top of that question.
I'll repeat it. Were the allegations that were made against Martin Bashir in the press at the post the interview, were they in the public interest, in your view? Were they of public interest?
They are in the public interest, of course.
Were they of public interest at the time, do you think?
I think they were of public interest.
Why didn't the BBC report on them at the time if they were of public interest?
Well, it's interesting because Lord Dyson asked me about this and referred to a particular piece, I think, by Paul Donovan in the Sunday Times, where Paul Donovan raised the issue of why didn't the BBC report on this? All I can say is that there was absolutely nothing from me that said this is not to be reported upon, completely not. Not least because I know in all my experience at the BBC that the best way to get a story covered in the BBC is to say, about the BBC, is to say don't cover it.
Yeah, because, okay. Well, you realised it wasn't reported at the time.
I can't recall at all. I don't think I'd be relieved or not relieved. I can't remember anything about that.
Were you surprised that it wasn't reported at the time, given that you say that you believed it was of public interest?
I can't recall 25 years ago whether I was surprised or not surprised.
Can you recall the feeling you had at the time about it not being reported after you'd done your investigation? Can you recall any reaction to that or thinking anything about it at the time? Or is it all a blank?
All I can say to you is it's very difficult looking back over 25 years, but can I just say I have never, ever, in all my years in the BBC, 35 years in the BBC, tried to stop a story about the BBC.
I'm sure. True law, but not what I'm asking you. I'm asking, can you recall any, you know, feelings, thoughts about the fact that this story wasn't being reported despite it appearing on the BBC, despite it appearing in the Sunday Times and other publications at the time, the Daily Mail?
I want to answer honestly to you, and I can't remember.
Okay.
What about 25 years ago. My apologies.
Okay. Lord Dyson doesn't believe the BBC's story on this in his report that all the news editors individually decided autonomously that the Bashir story was not newsworthy, and he believes the Sunday Times story about there being an official line not to report it is true. Is he wrong?
I think he is wrong, because all I can say is, in my part of it, I would never, and I know how I would have behaved then, because this is what I believe profoundly, that the way in which BBC editors report on the BBC and the independence within which they report on the BBC is an important part of our contract with the public. And so I don't understand quite how it was not reported at the time, but I would put it down to judgments by individual editors. That's the only way I can understand it.
How do you feel about Prince William's statement that his mother was, and I quote, failed not just by a rogue reporter, but by leaders at the BBC, who looked the other way rather than asking the tough questions?
I regret deeply that we didn't get to the bottom of Martin Bashir and what happened 25 years ago.
And you have said that. I'm asking you for permission to William's quote, because when he says, not just by a rogue reporter, but by leaders at the BBC, he's talking about you there, isn't he?
Well, we did what we thought was right at the time, investigating Martin Bashir, not once, but also twice. And I have a huge amount of respect for the Prince. I've worked with him on various things in the past. And I'm deeply sorry for the hurt this has caused to him. And I really do want to make that clear.
Have you spoken to him to express your deep sorrow and regret about it?
No, I haven't. I wanted to have this session with you all before I think what I do next.
On the issue of the appointment of Martin Bashir, it is quite surprising to me as someone, you know, who has a degree of respect for the BBC, that its recruitment and hiring policy seems to be less rigorous than the policies that I would deploy to employ a parliamentary researcher. When I appointed parliamentary researcher, I advertised the job externally, often get more than 200 applications, always go through all of the CVs, throw out the ones that can't spell my name, and keep the rest, and then create a long list and a short list and work with some of the people, interview, have some little practical exercises to see if they're suitable for the job, and appoint the best person for the job. It just really surprises me, you know, as someone who would regard themselves as a supporter of the BBC, that this kind of chumocracy approach to an appointment of somebody who was a proven liar with a very dodgy background was made. I mean, I suppose the only question I can ask you, you've made it clear you weren't involved, but what was your reaction when you heard that he'd been reappointed?
Well, I didn't know then what I know now. I remember thinking, and I think saying to James Harding that I hoped he delivered against his kind of brief. But I go back to you, it was not for me to second guess James's procedures for finding the right people, for finding the talent that he wanted to come and join News. That was for News to run through and to do.
Did you sort of kick the cat when you heard the point, or turn the air blue with frustration that this could have happened, knowing what you knew about his record, even if you didn't know everything you know now, you knew enough to be perhaps concerned about his reappointment? Would that be fair? Did you just shrug your shoulders about it?
No, I mean, I think I go back. You have to, in the end, say this is the appointment made by James Harding and Jonathan Munro in News Gathering. I would support them in their decision. I go back to the point that, you know, this is a highly devolved organisation, and you trust the people to find the right talented people to come.
All right, you've said that. Just finally, do you personally believe now, having, you know, been appraised of further information through all these inquiries, that Martin Bashir never actually showed those forged documents to Princess Diana?
Well, we had a letter from Princess Diana.
I know that, and we've got that on the record. Do you personally believe, though, that it's true, that given that we know that Princess Diana was in a vulnerable position, and that Martin Bashir was a deceiving, manipulative liar, isn't it entirely credible and possible, or do you think this isn't true, that he might have manipulated Princess Diana into writing that letter in order to cover his own tracks?
I can't say, but the letter from her, you know, 25 years ago, a letter in her own handwriting from the princess saying what she said, that she was not manipulated, that Martin Bashir told her nothing that she didn't already know, that she had no regrets at all, was very, very powerful. And I think when Lord Dyson also says that it was very likely she was going to do an interview somewhere, then I take that seriously too.
That's all from me, Chair.
Clive Afford. Yeah, I'd just like to follow up on that, because this goes back to this point I was trying to make earlier on, is what was the conceivable purpose of those documents being created in the first place? And isn't it likely that if he showed those documents to the Princess of Wales, that she says that the show was shown no documents that told her anything that she was not previously aware. Well, if she already thought that sort of coercion and bribery to gain information on her was happening, she would be able to write that, wouldn't it? Well, it doesn't actually say that she wasn't shown those statements.
Well, our understanding back then of why Bashir had produced those documents was as part of a file to do a story which he never, and Steve Hewlett said at the time, never pursued, looking at a whole raft of allegations around the royal family to do with bugging and all sorts of things like that. So that was the reason that he produced them, and that's the reason that seemed credible to us at the time.
And an acceptable explanation also.
Well, credible.
Thank you. John Nicholson.
Thank you, Chair. Lord Hall, have you any idea how utterly implausible it is that you were not closely involved in the monitoring of the rehiring of Martin Bashir, someone that you knew to be a serial liar? Because this wasn't any old rehiring. This was the talk of the newsroom at the BBC. People were wandering around saying to one another, can you believe it? Martin Bashir's back, and as religion correspondent. And you knew nothing about this. Come on.
Mr. Nicholson, I ask you to just consider the number of things that come across the desk of any Director General. And
yeah, but this is in a different scale, level, and importance. This is Martin Bashir. He'd been sacked twice in America for wrongdoing. You knew he was a serial liar, and he pops up at the BBC. The idea that you were unaware of this and not closely involved with it is just implausible.
Well, I was not involved in the rehiring of Martin Bashir, Mr. Nicholson, as yesterday's report makes clear.
Yeah. Well, the report's a whitewash.
I don't think it is, because it's reporting what I know to be the case as well. And it's been produced by a very independently minded person, namely Kenny McQuarrie.
A long-term BBC staffer.
But no, I was not constantly asking for briefings about one correspondent in one part of the news operation. Neither would I expect to be running the BBC. You've got a whole raft of things to do, negotiating a charter, running new services like BBC Sounds, moving more of the BBC out of London.
Yeah, we know what the job, we know what the job involves. Let's examine what you knew and when you knew it. Martin Bashir produced forged bank documents intended to make it look as if Diana's closest aides were corrupt and working against her. He showed these forgeries to groom Earl Spencer to secure an introduction to Diana. He lied about the way in which these documents had been used. Why didn't you pick up the phone and call Earl Spencer yourself and ask for his side of the story?
I think I've said already, but I'll repeat that I accept Lord Dyson's conclusion that we should have picked up the phone to Earl Spencer.
But why didn't you? Why didn't you?
Because at the time we were doing two things. One is Steve Hewlett had spoken to Earl Spencer. But as I said before, looking back at it, we can't. Well, what we saw back then was that he'd spoken to Earl Spencer when the Mail on Sunday story came out.
But what about you? I want to know why you didn't pick up the phone. I mean, this is basic rookie journalist stuff. There's a controversy. There's obviously two sides to the story. You ask one person their view, and then you pick up the phone and you ask the other person their view. You're a disciple of Bertism. This is the very basis of Bertism, is you do some research. You didn't do any research at all, did you?
Anne Sloan and Tim Souter did the research.
So it was all their fault?
And no, they did the research. Anne and I then interviewed Martin Bashir. But the point is, we were looking at something narrower, and in retrospect, in terms of Dyson, that was a mistake. But the narrow point we were trying to make was, had Bashir breached his guidelines, and then what do we do about that?
Well, you shouldn't have set such narrow parameters. You should have gone where the story led you. But of course, worse, you painted Earl Spencer as a co-conspirator with Bashir, involved in falsifying the content of forged bank statements. You'll understand Earl Spencer's outrage at this. I have in front of me here the document that you wrote, and you said that Earl Spencer had showed some documents to Martin Bashir, including a bank statement. Earl Spencer did no such thing. Martin Bashir showed the forged documents. And you wrote this and gave it to the board, and it was false. And it's got your name on it.
And I accept that that it's false because we were lied to by Martin Bashir.
And you did no research. And now, you met Martin Bashir and reported back to John Burt. He is an honest and an honourable man. But you knew he wasn't. So let's look back at the Tim Gardam memo. Now, he was the head of weekly programmes. And he'd given you this memo, and it had told you that Martin Bashir had had lied three times. What happened to that memo that he gave to you?
I acted upon it as Tim Gardam in his memo, which you've got in front of you, makes very clear, we should look into this all over again. We did exactly that with Tim Souter and Anne Sloman.
Where is the memo?
I presume you're reading the memo given by Tim Gardam to Lord Dyson.
Yeah, but where is the original copy that was given to you?
I'm sorry, I don't know, but I'm reading...
Did you place it in the BBC? This is a very important document. Did you place it in the BBC's files with the other Bashir notes?
I can't tell you. This is 25 years ago, Mr. Nicholson, and I can't tell you what happened to the various documents that...
It's gone missing. Did you destroy it?
Absolutely not. I mean, can I just go back to my position and the way that I looked at all these things? I approached this with an open-minded way, trying to get to the truth, and we, and not just me, but others, were lied to by Martin Bashir, and that's at the root of it. We were in no way to cover up
but
something.
But you knew he lied to you, so you're not telling us something that's new. You knew that at the time. Well, fortunately, this missing document, which is so key to the Dyson inquiry, it found its way to Lord Dyson. Now, you'll understand why this document is so important, because it predates all your assurances to the board about Bashir's honesty. It shows that you knew he'd lied to secure the interview, because a senior colleague had told you that. And this document has disappeared. Fortunately, its original author had kept a copy of it, which is why Lord Dyson got it. Lord Dyson called you woefully ineffective, and even more damningly, Prince William said that you chose to look the other way. Do you know how much the Dyson inquiry cost?
No, you have to ask the BBC that.
Well, I can tell you. It cost £1.4 million. That's 9,000 licence fees directly as a result of your negligence. Lord Hall, it's really very hard to believe that you were once thought of as a safe pair of hands. Having presided over the BBC Equal Pay cover-up, the pensioners' TV licence fiasco, and now this scandal, don't you think perhaps that a forfeit of some of your lavish BBC pension would be appropriate?
Let me just say that I have been a public servant for 35 years at the BBC. running news. I then left and did public service running the Royal Opera House, which is, at that time was in crisis. I rescued the Olympics for the Olympics in 2012, and I came back to the BBC, which I never thought I ever would do or wanted to, in 2013, to rescue the BBC from the crisis that was involving Savile. 25 years ago, myself and everybody believed Bashir. We made a mistake. But please don't let that colour the other things that I've done, and which I can enumerate, but obviously won't, in terms of my public record of public service over 35 years. I've done a hell of a lot for the BBC and I think for the arts. And I regret this one thing that we all got wrong because we were lied to by Martin Bashir 25 years ago.
Some rescue, Lord Hall. It was clear that you were negligent in the way you carried out this investigation. You say that you believed Martin Bashir, but in fact you knew he was a liar. And the key witness in all of this, Earl Spencer, you didn't bother to pick up the phone to ask him some questions. It's something a rookie journalist would have done. There's been a BBC cover-up, which is why you and the other witnesses are now here. Back to you, Chair.
Can I just say a comment on that, Mr. Nicholson, which is, number one, I accept we should have spoken to Earl Spencer. I accept that conclusion from Lord Dyson's report. One of us should have gone back to to Earl Spencer on this issue of the documents. I accept that. But can I also say that we have not tried to conceal from the public or anyone any of the conclusions we came to around this 25 years ago. The notion that there's been some consistent line that we've drawn under this, trying to conceal something from the public, is not true. We thought we'd come to a conclusion 25 years ago, an honest conclusion, based on somebody who was contrite and was prepared to see he'd made a big mistake, someone we thought was inexperienced and out of his depths. We got that wrong. We believed him. And I'm sorry for that.
Thank you. Back to you.
Thank you. Charles Watling.
Thank you, Chair. Lord Hall, there's one thing I don't quite understand. You repeatedly said to the Chair and Kevin Brennan and just now to Mr. Nicholson that there's a great deal that the Director General has to devolve, and that's understandable with the 20,000 employees, etc. But as you just said, you were brought in to deal with the fallout from the Savile affair, the appalling Savile affair. And coming in on the back of that, I don't understand why you weren't on your mettle more and put mechanisms in place to ensure the honesty, openness and truthfulness that we all expect from the BBC, because damage has been done. And I would have thought you would have been all over that on your arrival, and then the Bashir thing happened.
When I came back into the BBC to deal with the Savile crisis, and it was a real crisis, there were three investigations going on into what should be done. I accepted all three. When it came to the final report on how this had happened by an eminent judge, I spoke to survivors and I then ensured that we had the policies in place to ensure that such a thing could not happen again. The same thing happened with bullying and harassment. The same thing happened with equal pay, which again was an issue that we were dealing with. I brought in changes to the way that, when I came back to the BBC, the way that people were employed, terms and conditions and so on, that had not been done for a generation. We were reforming the culture of the BBC to make it a better place to work, a place where people could say what they felt and did not feel they would be bullied or would be cowed in some way into submission. And that's because fundamentally I believe in teams, and fundamentally I believe in people giving of their best in the workforce. I really do. And when I came back to the BBC, that's what I wanted to achieve.
I appreciate all that, and it's all very worthy. It is just that, having come in on the back of such an enormous crisis with such far-reaching effect, that you didn't actually put into place mechanisms whereby the Bashir affair could never have happened.
I don't think the Bashir affair, as I said to one of your colleagues earlier on, would happen in the same way now, or rather, the way that we would investigate it, had it happened, would be very, very different. And I did bring in policies around whistleblowing, which were very, very clear. Whistleblowing now, if you want to whistleblow, then if you're still not satisfied, it goes right up to the board level. There is a board member who's responsible for whistleblowing. We had whistleblowing policies. We had ways in which you could complain about behaviours and so on. Editorial policy is now much, much stronger within the BBC and is much more powerfully felt within the BBC, and people use it properly. So there's that too. And I think we have, all in all, better controls. But you would know, when you're dealing with thousands of decisions being made each day, which are difficult editorial decisions being made from a local radio station through to the World Service, you know, you do need people to understand the guidelines. You need people to understand what is good and what is bad, what is good journalism, what's bad journalism. And I think we did a huge amount in my time with James Harding and then latterly with Fran Unsworth to ensure that those guidelines and what we wanted from our journalists was understood.
Okay, thank you. I just think that, that perhaps there was too much devolution, but thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's fine. I know that the time is running short, Lord Hall. We do appreciate the fact that you you volunteered today. Not everyone wishes to volunteer to come in front of our select committee, I have to say. I'm just wondering whether or not you thought, first of all, whether or not you received any sort of other complaints regarding Martin Bashir's journalism during his time at the BBC, perhaps in relation to Terry Venables and the faking of documents in that case.
Yes, there was an issue around Terry Venables' Panorama, which was dealt with at the time. I can't remember the details now, but I think I mentioned it in my report to the governors.
And that was 2 years before the Diana was a fake documents. So he was a faker of documents of long standing then.
Well, I can't remember the details of the Terry Venables case.
Well, what happened was, the details are pretty public domain, actually. What happened was that there was a payment and loan to Terry Venables, and this was graphicised, or graphics were brought up in order to show this loan, but those graphics were fake. So effectively it showed like a bank statement that was fake, and that was broadcast on Newsnight 2 years prior to Princess Diana being shown, or having been involved with fake documents by the same reporter.
Yeah, and that's why I was clear about bringing in guidelines to make sure that these fake documents... I mean, that hit air, from what you're saying. This document...
That was 30 years ago. That was 30 years ago when that happened. Nearly 30 years ago. When he was faking documents at the BBC, and 2 years prior to Princess Diana.
And the question is, Chair?
The question is, I introduced new guidelines... at a much later date, obviously, editorial guidelines, with Mr. Eyre, I think it was, the gentleman you mentioned.
That's right. That was after this faking of documents in the Princess Diana issue.
Right, okay. But were you aware that he'd also faked documents for Terry Venables?
I can't recall. This is going back a very long time, but obviously the Terry Venables Panorama was something that which myself and Mr. Gardam would have known about at the time.
Right, okay, fine. If you'd been DG at the time that Lord Dyson revealed his report, would you have resigned?
Well, I wasn't a Director General. I'd left long before it. So
well, not so long ago. You could say that actually it was very timely your leaving. You obviously resigned at the National Gallery, but do you think it would be the right thing for you morally to have resigned at that point?
I really can't answer that question. I mean, I left the BBC some 9 or 10 months before to go and take up the chair of the National Gallery. I obviously didn't know that this was about to emerge onto the scene.
You weren't aware that it was about to emerge onto the scene?
No, okay. Of course not.
What was, just finally, one question for you. Do you think that what Mr. Bashir did was criminal?
I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, and it would not be for me to say whether what he did was criminal.
Well, the
or not.
Definition of fraud is one which you gain financial gain through false pretenses. He gained financially.
He didn't. I don't think he gained from this financially at all. But lawyers better.
Well, in terms of his career, he got the biggest interview that there's been in British TV history almost, and that is a really big. To gain, is it not? And it therefore has a financial consequence down the line.
Martin Bashir didn't gain from that financially. The BBC might have done, and I think some of the monies went to charity, as I recall, but I don't think Martin Bashir gained from it.
Okay. We'll leave. Thank you very much, Lord Hall. That concludes our first panel. We'll take a short adjournment of 2 minutes. while we prepare our second panel. Order, order.
Thank you.
Oh, you guys don't have lunch plans.
Well, we've got to finish our one, haven't we?
Stop me if you heard this one.
Hello, Lord Burt.
Oh, stop.
I thought you said that there was a...
That meant it had to stop.
Hello, Lord Burt, are you there?
That's the line that Stephen uses every week.
Broadcasting colleagues, our broadcasting colleagues are stuck there.
Oh, right, okay.
But usually the rooms, and there's a committee book, and it happens
to the change of room. Hello, Lord Burt.
Hello.
Hello. That's okay, we'll be starting shortly.
Good.
Okay, thank you.
I'll come straight to you, Steve.
Okay, Lord Burt, I'll give a countdown. Five count, and then we'll be going live after. So we will be going public in five, four, three.
Order, order. This is Digital Culture Media and Sports Select Committee, and this is our special hearing to the work of the BBC in light of the Bashir scandal. On panel two, we have Lord Burt, former Director General of the BBC. Good morning, Lord Burt.
Good morning.
Good morning. First question is from Steve Bryan.
Good morning, Lord Burt. Thank you very much for joining us. And just for those watching, you were obviously Director General of the BBC from 1992 to 2000. The interview with Princess Diana took place in November 1995, so that was during your tenure, just to be clear. Can I ask you, Lord Burt, at what point did the BBC Management Board develop the awareness of the allegations against Martin Bashir?
It, of course, depends what allegations you mean, but the report from Lord Hall, which has already been discussed, went to the Board of Management and the Board of Governors, and it was on the basis of those reports that an understanding was reached.
The allegations that I refer to are that the interview was secured under false pretense. There were questions being asked pretty soon after it was broadcast, and obviously it led to a number of investigations. What was your personal feelings as the leader of the organisation when that report from Lord Hall landed on your desk?
Well, if I may, I've obviously just followed the proceedings with Lord Hall. If I may, I think a little context might be helpful to the committee to try to understand these events, because I don't think a clear understanding has emerged from the discussion so far. And it is a very difficult story to understand, but I might say that I have only understood some of the most important aspects of this story in recent weeks. So I think the backdrop is of a reporter who deceived on a very, very significant scale. And I don't think the scale of his deception has remotely been understood in the public discourse. And there were two completely different deceptions, and you can't understand what happened unless you understand what those two deceptions were. The first deception, which was cunning and callous, was the one that he meted out to first Earl Spencer and to Princess Diana to persuade them that she was a victim of betrayal and espionage. And if you read a very important document, Richard Kay's interview with Earl Spencer, you will see that Martin Bashir came to the table with literally scores of examples and allegations. He alleged to her and to Earl Spencer that her phones were tapped, that her letters were opened, that she had a tracker on her car, her driver and her friends were leaking. And most importantly, the Prince Charles's private secretary was marshalling a campaign against her. Over and beyond that, a very large number of stories about the press and about Prince Charles's private life. And the documents were obviously the only tangible evidence that Bashir offered Earl Spencer. We all know now that they were fakes, and we know what that is. But then you've got to understand the second deception, if you were to understand how events then played out, because if it weren't for the fact that Matt Fiesler came forward, I suspect we'd have never known any of this. But after he came forward, Martin Bashir had a problem, which he had to ensure that he escaped detection for his wrongdoing by his bosses. And he promptly created another long, complex narrative. He said, and if you look at the document in Lord Dyson's appendices, you will see it there. He claimed, and this is the document being Lord Hall's long-form report of his interview with Martin Bashir, he named individual officers of the security services and GCHQ whom he said alleged a concerted campaign, again, of surveillance and interception, marshalled by Prince Charles's private secretary. He alleged that a friend of Princess Diana's had driven him around and shown him the junction box. If you watch John Ware's Panorama, you'll find that that friend says she never met Martin Bashir. And this is absolutely critical. Unless you understand this point, you can't understand what then happened. He said that when he met Earl Spencer, gave him copies of the bank statements of his head of security, Alan Waller. And that was the prime basis for the documents. That information from Earl Spencer was supplemented by information that he then said he got from Princess Diana about the two payments on the documents, one from News International, the other from, and here he made a big mistake, he made up a name but said that this was a front for the security services and that Waller was in their pay. This was extensive cunning considered and deeply callous because of the impact it had on many of the individuals concerned. And he was utterly oblivious of the harm that he was causing. But that was the backdrop that he presented and the essence of the story from my point of view. And by the way, I have only understood the story I just recounted over recent weeks and months. The essence of the story is that he fooled the BBC executives concerned, and you've just given Lord Hall a very hard time. You have to remember that five extremely seasoned BBC executives, none of them faceless bureaucrats, Steve Hewlett, whom you probably all know, Tim Souter, Tim Garden, Anne Sloman, and Tony Hall himself. And the sad fact is that they believed his story. Unless you understand that, you can't understand what subsequently happened, because when it was presented at the Board of Management and Board of Governors, the so-called document was presented as something that was essentially authored by Earl Spencer himself. And that helps you to understand the answer why nobody thought it right to go back to Earl Spencer, because they thought he was the prime author.
Yeah,
nonsense. Mm. But unless you understand all of that, you can't understand how events played out.
Yeah, no, thank you. What a guy that you had in your team. I'm glad you mentioned the Board of Governors, because there was a lot of tension at the time between yourself and Duke Hussey, wasn't there, as chairman of the board? They were quite strained, those relations. And obviously he had very close relationships with senior members of the royal family. The allegation was that the board was kept out of the loop about the planning of the interview and then the aftermath from it. So I just wonder, how did the relationship between the chair of the Board of Governors and the royal family influence how you as DG dealt with the allegations at the time. You see, the reason we ask this is because we're interested in getting to the truth of decision making and how decisions were made and scrutinising that. And this seems to me to be a rather interesting part of the plot, Lord Bird.
It had no impact whatsoever. Tony Hall reported up his best understanding. We now know a completely flawed understanding of what exactly had happened. And we all believe that was an honest account. And that was one that was shared by the Board of Management, the Board of Governors. And by the way, one that I believed for the best part of 25 years. And it came as a great shock to me when I read Tim Suter's email well after, account well after Lord Dyson's account inquiry started. In which I learned for the first time that Martin Bashir had lied. So it simply is not the case that anybody set out to deceive, other than Martin Bashir himself. As you say, quite a guy. And unless you understand this was a serial liar on an industrial scale, you simply can't understand the story. And moreover, in fairness to some of the people involved, in 100 years of BBC journalism, can we think of anybody else who behaved in that kind of way? So, yes, they all believed him, hardened and experienced though they were, and we know they were wrong to believe him. Hmm. But we also can see some of the reasons why. You know, the aura of Princess Diana, her letter. And you've only got to look at the interview itself and other work that Martin Bashir has done, is that he is a very skilled confidence trickster. He uses emotion. He's very persuasive. He cried in his interview with Tony Hall and Sloman and fessed up to the fact that he'd shown the documents to Earl Spencer. He didn't fess up to the fact that he had created those documents from his own information and continued to argue, as I think he still does, that Earl Spencer was, as well as Princess Diana, were the prime suppliers of information to those.
Yes, states. Lord Burt, I'm just going to interrupt because all time is pressing. I mean, you are giving this is your chance to give your version of events, as it were, and the world is watching, and you're giving a very compelling argument that, you know, you were all naively deceived by a clever man. It reminds me of the people who appear on the radio to talk about a fraudster that phoned them up and tricked them into giving their bank details. But of course, 2 years previously, when the Venables case came up, which our chair was raising with Lord Hall, who, for the record, we didn't give a hard time to at all, that was us being very benign. Were you not aware of the Venables debacle 2 years previously, when this same confidence trickster had seemingly used the same MO?
Well, I simply don't know. You can't overstate enough the difficulty of trying to remember things. You're a young man, and in 25 years' time, you'll find that you've struggled to remember the detail of lots of things in your life. So I have absolutely no memory whatsoever of the... by the way, I have almost no memory whatsoever of the things we're talking about. Everything I've learned is from a close study of the documents. But from my understanding from the documents, not from a memory at the time... Actually, the Venables document is not a parallel. I can stand corrected on it. My best understanding, it wasn't just Martin Bashir. There was a Panorama producer involved. And my best understanding, possibly not true, was that document was compiled on the back of somebody reading into a tape recorder a document that actually existed that they had seen and that they had then created. Yeah. So it was a facsimile of a real document. And if you look at the contemporary, the evidence that is now available, the producer, and I presume Martin Bashir himself was scolded for not making clear on air, that it wasn't, that the viewers were not seeing an original document. They were seeing something that was created. But my understanding, and as I say, it may be imperfect, was that actually that was a facsimile of a document that really existed.
Yeah. Okay. Just a couple. And then I'll close and hand back. We'll come on to that in more detail. I just want to return to the question I asked Lord Hall at the very start. You were the DG at the time. The fact that a very junior reporter landed the scoop of the century. I know your memory is vague, but presumably you remember thinking that that was, uh, That was an incredible feat that he achieved, don't you? Did it ring any alarm bells at all, Lord Burt?
No, absolutely none. I mean, I think you can overstate the junior. He's in his early 30s. He's worked in the BBC a number of years. He's worked on other current affairs programme. He's risen up the ranks to Panorama. What I did understand and is embedded in my memory is that he didn't. I mean, I think he probably did set out to get an interview with Princess Diana, but that's not the story that was being told. What he set out was to make a panorama on the surveillance of Princess Diana's royal family. Not an unreasonable thing to do, because remember, in the previous couple of years, two private phone calls, one from Princess Diana, one from Prince Charles, had been intercepted and published. So it wasn't fanciful to assume that there were difficulties around surveillance and bugging of members of the royal family. And my understanding is that was the journey he set out on. Now, given what we now know about how he thinks and how he calculates, and given the skill with which he assembled the yarn that he took to Earl Spencer, I think we can be reasonably suspicious that he had that as his objective
yeah,
all along.
But you didn't think, you know, why has Nick Whit got this?
No, absolutely not.
Okay,
why would one? You know, you wouldn't stare a gift horse in the mouth. You know, you're being told, just as Lord Hall said, he only knew a couple of weeks before. I knew even less time.
I think you said something very interesting there. You wouldn't look a gift horse in the mouth. I have any feeling that my chairman might return to that. Just finally, can I just ask you this, Lord Burt? You know, I'm interested in your personal feelings about this now, given the recollection that you've learned in recent months about this.
New knowledge.
Yes, your new knowledge. So with your new knowledge, you were the boss. You were the DG when this went on. An interview with one of the most famous people on the planet was attained under false pretense. Reputations were trashed. Matt Beasler as an example. And in the words of the Duke of Cambridge, this made lurid and false claims about the royal family, which played on her fears, his mother, and fueled her paranoia. Yeah. So fears and let me finish. Her fears and her paranoia, which it's not a great stretch to say, sparked a train of events which less than 2 years later would see the events in that underpass in Paris. So reflecting now, with the passing of time and your learned knowledge, the many things that you've done since, including, remember, you were strategy advisor to Prime Minister Tony Blair for 5 years. Is this your Iraq war, Mr. Burt?
It is a tragic occurrence. It is an absolute horror story. And it should never have happened, and it is a complete embarrassment that it did happen. None of us can speculate. My heart goes out to the sons of Princess Diana, but none of us can truly speculate and understand what the consequences were. What we can understand is that this was a plane crash. It shouldn't have happened, and you probably want to discuss how it might have been avoided and what the BBC might do to ensure that it never happens again.
And at that point, I'll hand back to the chair.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, Lord Burt. You've answered in some part what I was about to ask you about the Board of Governors meeting on the 15th of April 1996, about Lord Hall's update to that meeting. I wanted to know what you made of it. You've expressed what you think of that, but can you actually, in reflection on what else you said, can you actually remember the board meeting?
No.
Know what you thought at the time?
Absolutely not. I don't remember it. And I think that the committee may find that surprising. But by the way, I haven't met anybody who does remember it, and there may be people who do. Lord Dyson doesn't appear to have surfaced them. And I think, however hard it is to understand, it is because of the nature of the report that Lord Hall made, which we've exhaustively discussed so far, about what the origin of those documents was.
Please may I finish?
A recognition that those documents should not have been created, and the reprimanding of the reporter concerned, but and a letter from Princess Diana. All of these things reported to the board. And it didn't, it's embarrassing to say it now, but it didn't have the consequence at the time because of all that, because of that very limited and wrong understanding of events. It didn't have the impact that in hindsight you might think it would have done. And, but, you know, by the way, there were some very weighty people around that board table, as there were around the board management table. And there is no record of anybody seriously challenging that, because it was a convincing, completely wrong, but a convincing yarn at the time.
So two things there. One thing, I accept 25 years ago, I remember some things I did that year. I don't remember everything. Most people remember things of personal significance. Yeah. However, the Diana interview, the Princess of Wales interview, was such a huge thing, probably one of the most memorable things yes. that I can remember watching on television in Indeed. My life.
Indeed.
So it wasn't that it was an insignificant
No, absolutely not.
Thing that you were talking about. That's why I'm very surprised that you have no recollection.
No, well, I didn't say I had no recollection of events surrounding the interview, because you are quite right. This was an extremely important event in my life and that of everybody else concerned. And I have a reasonable recollection of those things where I myself was, so to speak, in the lead. And for instance, in discussion of the interview itself, whether I led the discussion about whether it was legitimate to do it, and if we did do it, what was it reasonable to ask Princess Diana and what we shouldn't ask Princess Diana. I don't have a detailed understanding of that meeting, but I can remember the occasion, and I can remember some of the things I said, and I can clearly remember what I thought at the time. And I had to make a decision, because Princess Diana only imposed one condition, which was that she and only she should inform the Queen when the interview was done. And I had to think about that and agree it. And I can clearly remember, because my main problem, it was, as has already been alluded to, I'd had an excellent relationship with the chairman of the BBC over the best part of 10 years, but it had deteriorated over the previous year. And he was, I don't particularly want to go into what had happened to him as the years went on and so forth, but he became more and more difficult and unreasonable. And he had, and everybody knew it, very, very strong views about the royal family and things I would not repeat about his views about Princess Diana. So I had to, the hardest thing for me, and which I clearly remember, was having to decide what to do about that. And in the end, I decided he would be told essentially 7 days before transmission, but not before the interview, because I judged that if he were told, he would frustrate it, and that would have been wrong for the BBC. That was a very difficult decision for me, and in making it, one that I said to my wife at the time, I expected that I would lose my job on the back of it, but I thought it was the right decision. And I can remember clearly the events that followed that, because he made a great fuss at the board, and I had further meetings with members of the board, and in the end, they supported me. And all those things I remember, but self-evidently from Lord Hall's account, this investigation was conducted not just by Lord Hall, but all the other people we've mentioned in line. And then that was reported up to me, and I have a very limited memory of that.
Yeah, you had no reason to question Lord Hall's evidence to Board of Directors.
Absolutely not. The same as everybody else. If you have, and Lord Hall's talked about trust. I knew all five people in that line. They are all people of real integrity and ability and experience. And if somebody tells me that those five people are standing behind that, believe me, I'm going to believe it. And I did.
So if we move on to the BBC's internal investigations into the allegations around Martin Bashir, without being approached by the BBC, how could Earl Spencer have presented himself for questioning in that process?
I think Earl Spencer has been asked why he didn't come forward, and I respect his answer, which was he was very concerned for the welfare of his sister, and he didn't want to after the interview went out, he didn't want to undermine her by revealing all of his doubts about the process that he'd been involved in. I think when he did talk to people, because as Lord Hall has already mentioned, he talked to some members of the BBC, he actually raised other issues, not the documents. My best understanding is that Earl Spencer himself didn't understand the documents were fake. But if as I discussed this at length with Lord Dyson, if we had gone to Earl Spencer, we would have discovered, and I think there were very good reasons why people, it didn't occur to them, but if we had have done, we would have understood the complete incompatibility between Martin Bashir's narrative and Earl Spencer's, because what Earl Spencer says is, Martin Bashir showed me these documents at the beginning of the process, late August, early September. What Martin Bashir told his colleagues in the BBC is these documents were created, as I've said, on the basis of information from Spencer and Princess Diana, just very briefly, in October, not long before the interview was conducted. And it's that disparity in the evidence that finally, when Earl Spencer did come forward, started to unravel Martin Bashir's story, because it was unraveled until then. Indeed, it took the reasons you won't want to go into, because there were subplots. It wasn't even then unraveled satisfactorily, because there were some difficulties in reconciling the two accounts.
So you would accept, I think, that if Earl Spencer had been interviewed at that point by the BBC's internal investigations, this would have come to light long before it has done.
Without a doubt, and I discussed this with Lord Dyson. Of course, if Earl Spencer had come forward with the account that he finally came forward November in the interview he gave Richard Kay, it would have blown Martin Bashir's account right apart immediately, and the history would have been different. And very, very sorry indeed that it took 25 years for this terrible story to emerge.
And finally, can I just ask, you obviously would have been aware of Martin Bashir at the time, I'm sure you would have met him.
Absolutely not. I didn't meet him at the time, and as far as I know, I never met him since, and I doubt I was even aware of him.
You weren't aware of him?
I doubt I was aware of him. You know, as Lord Hall keeps saying, the BBC is a very, very big organisation.
The person who did the biggest interview.
No, sorry, I thought you were saying, was I aware of it in advance? Was I aware of him before this interview? I don't expect I was.
In the time that you were Director General, which was after this interview as well, you will have been aware of Martin Bashir. Was there anything, just a gut feeling or anything, that rang alarm bells about this man at the time, before, after, during that period?
I'm not sure I entirely understand the question. Absolutely no alarm bells at all, for all the reasons I talked about earlier. The quiet, gentle, emotionally sympathetic manner that you see in the interview itself. No, there were no alarm bells. Frankly, alarm bells rang subsequently big time with me when he got into trouble in America and the appalling things he said about Sarah Palin and his ill-judged comments about Asian babes. And to be honest also, nobody else has mentioned this, I felt very uneasy about what he did with Michael Jackson. And that was the first time that my doubts started to kick in. And indeed, you can't be definitive about what he did with Michael Jackson. But I never liked the smell of that, and the lack of the failure to reach proper conclusions in that. So I did subsequently think, goodness me, I'm not sure about this person.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Clive Efford.
Thank you, Chair. Lord Burt, you've read the Lord Dyson's report and you've listened to Lord Hall's evidence this morning. Is there anything, looking back on that period, that you feel let down by?
If you've read Lord Dyson's report, you will see, because he and I met at the very end of his deliberations, he and I had a very good conversation, I think, about all of this, and he fairly reports it in his report, and he also reveals that he and I disagreed. I think he judges my former colleagues too harshly, given the circumstances that I shared with the committee earlier. And you know, if you say, do you have regrets? Then, I mean, I don't know how many of these people you've met, but Steve Hewlett had a take no prisoners personality. He was not a man you got on the wrong side of. He was extremely forthright. Tim Gardam is one of the sharpest minds of anybody I've ever met. Tim Souter went on to very important jobs. Anne Sloman, has already been mentioned, was a significant figure in radio. So none of them spotted. Maybe another person might have spotted the discrepancies in his testimony, and there is a mystery about why Tim Gardam's report never informed subsequent deliberations. So, you know, yes, it would have been terrific if one of them had spotted flaws, had dug deeper, and so on and so forth. But I have to say, as the Director General at the time, this was my team, and these were people that I respected, and are people of real integrity. So, you know, of course, we can all completely agree that what happened is deeply, deeply regrettable, but it's better to understand how it happened and then to work out what would you do to make sure that it never happened again. But again, recognizing this is probably a 1 in 100 year occurrence of having a rogue reporter who's willing to be deceitful on this scale.
Well, it's not the first time to be deceived on a massive scale, but we're probably not best go down that rabbit
hole. Perhaps you'd remind me of when those other occasions are.
Well, Jimmy Savile would be a big one that would jump out at me. I know there's massive amnesia at the BBC, but I'm sure you've not forgotten that. So could I just ask you that you've said that that you know this was a very devious individual that misled everybody, and the BBC and all its officials and all its really hot top reporters were all just bamboozled by this individual over a long period of time. But Mr. Weasler came forward after the broadcast. What happened then? Was that brought to your attention?
Only in the context of Lord Hall's report, and you've already talked to Lord Hall about that. He reports, and indeed the documentation, which we can all study, is completely clear about what happened when Matt Weasler came forward. He was respected as a whistleblower by Tim Gardam. Tim Gardam acted with real dispatch and vigour, immediately confronted Martin Bashir about it. He got the story. Tim Gardam got the letter from Princess Diana, and he was reassured by that letter, and he went back to Matt Weasler to say, don't worry, because Matt Weasler was completely understandable. It was perfectly legitimate for him to come forward. And he was given the assurance, I see from the documentation, I knew nothing of this at the time, by Tim Gardam, that they had checked that the documents were not shown to Princess Diana, and he should feel reassured.
So, we've got a fairly junior reporter at Panorama, who Lord Hall has just told us faked these documents, and when interviewed about it, disclosed that he was investigating all sorts of things around the royal family and the Princess of Wales. So it goes beyond just those fake documents, and you've said that yourself, that he gave a litany of
evidence. Yeah, that was the purpose of... That was the journey he was on, and his editor had followed that journey with him. This didn't start off. It may have done in Martin Bashir's mind, but in everybody else's mind, it started off as a panorama about surveillance on the royal family.
Right, but look, Dyson there was an irregularity in the fact that he didn't have his hand held by a producer, which was quite strange for somebody who was as junior as that. So he discloses to the head of news, Lord Hall, that he is not only produced fake documents, but he's also investigating lots of things around the royal family. Now, given the sensitivities of that information, shouldn't someone have come and knocked on your door?
No. I honestly think you fail to appreciate the sequence here. He's under the stewardship of his editor, Steve Hewlett, and Steve Hewlett, as far as I understand it, does understand that Martin Bashir, over many months, is doing a programme about the surveillance of the royal family. If that had turned into a panorama, somebody would have knocked at my door, because it was my practice, whenever, as everybody will be aware, it was my practice when there was a really difficult panorama which raised either severe legal or public policy issues. From the moment I arrived at the BBC, first as Deputy Director General in charge of news, indeed in charge of actually forming BBC News for the first time, previously being five separate divisions. I'm sorry, I've lost my way. Please remind me.
Let me take you back, because
I do understand. I remembered the question. If that had turned into a panorama about the surveillance of the royal family, a red flag would have gone up, and it would have come to me. And as with other difficult panoramas, I've reviewed it personally. I've seen the programme. And very often, I would be accompanied in that process by a leading QC.
Sorry, I missed the beginning of what you said. Repeat. What did you say right at the start of that sentence? If it had been what?
Sorry, if the programme that he set out to make about the surveillance of the royal family, if that had turned into a real programme, then there would have been a red flag. And as was my practice, that programme, any programme that raised significant legal or public policy issues, and there's only a handful of panoramas a year that would do that, would come to me, and I would personally review it, and I would often do it accompanied by a leading QC to sign it off. Why did I do this? Because when I arrived at the BBC, the reason I was invited into the BBC, the first person at that level since the Second World War, is because an awful lot of things had gone wrong, and particularly a panorama had gone wrong, where the BBC had lost a major legal action in court. And to be honest, the BBC's processes for managing difficult programmes were terrible. And I changed those processes, and it would have come to me, but it wouldn't have come to me until it was a real programme in prospect.
Well, so I'm a little bit amused by that, because so if it had been about security surveillance of the royal family, that would have come to your across your desk. But the scoop of the century to this one-to-one interview with the Princess of Wales, with all of the international news interest about no one bothered to come and tell you we're about to secure this interview. There are some and later on saying that there may be some issues about how that was obtained. No one came to you as Director General and said...
Well, they are two different issues, and I have already said that people did come to me. It was seen as a highly sensitive programme, and I was involved, as I've already said, in the discussions about that programme, its legitimacy and what and its purpose and what it should contain. Your second question is completely different, and when did we become aware that there was a problem is when the Mail published in, when did I become aware there was a problem is when the Mail published the false documents in the following year. And that launched Tony Hall and Anne Sloman's investigation. And to the best of my knowledge and memory, that was the first time I was aware of it. And then Tony properly reported that up to myself, the Board of Management and the Board of Governors.
Well, given your rigorous approach to news and making sure people checked, all sides of stories. Did you question anyone about why no one, particularly Anne Sloman and Lord Hall, Did you question why they didn't contact Earl Spencer?
Well, I've already said, I think I've answered that question.
We're
talking
about
five people I trusted who had dealt with this issue, and I believe what they told me. And I not only believe what they told me, I believed in their integrity, which I still do.
And so you maintain that this is all of the fault of Martin Bashir, who is a very believable individual, but a liar and nonetheless, and that you, from the top of the BBC, through the head of news, all those investigative journalists at the Panorama, in spite of the fact that Mr. Weasler had come forward stating that they faked the documents, that there was evidence that Martin Bashir had lied, all of that, you were all just innocents abroad, completely deceived by it.
I've already said, on the one hand, he was beguiling and persuasive. On the other, I've said already, of course we would wish in a better world that somebody or other had smelled a rat, but they didn't. And remember the importance of the letter from Diana and the impact that would have had, not on me, but on the people concerned. Yes, I'm not suggesting for a minute it's not highly regrettable. It's an appalling event. And yes, of course, it would have been terrific if people had spotted the flaw at the time, but they didn't. And it's important now to understand the lessons 25 years on.
The question has to be,
avoid it happening again.
Anne Snowman and Lord were conducting this investigation in March 1996. Lord Hall was aware of the Tim Garden email. They were also aware of the fact that Mr. Visa had come forward and made it clear the dates on which he had produced the statements on behalf of Martin Bashir. It has to be, the question has to be asked, why that didn't come across your desk and how it was that you accepted a report that said that he was honest and honourable. I mean, how can you do that?
Honestly, forgive me, you don't understand how a very large organisation works. You delegate things to the right level. And by the way, it isn't the case that Matt Weisler was clear about date. Indeed, that's, I referred earlier to complex subplots. If you read the mail of March 1996, you will see that Matt Weisler says in that he created the documents in October. 25 years later, in the same edition that Richard Kay writes the long form and hugely valuable report of Earl Spencer's experience, in that very same edition, Matt Weisler is still saying he created the documents in October, which is consistent with what Martin Bashir told us, which was obviously a lie, and was inconsistent with Earl Spencer's own account. So I'm sure that was a completely innocent mistake on Matt Weisler's part, but it was a mistake. And that did confuse matters for quite some time.
I'll leave it to Clive. I've heard victim blaming before, but my word. Lord Burt,
Could you expand on that, please?
Well, I'm going to.
That's
what I'm going to do. You stated before that Mr. Weisler was respected as a whistleblower. That's what your statement was before. Now, Lord Hall's report to you, Lord Burt, stated the following. The final point concerns the actions of those who leaked material to the press. We are taking steps to ensure that the graphic designer involved, Matthew Weisler, will not work for the BBC again, brackets when the current contract expires in the next few weeks. In addition, between now and the summer, we will work to deal with leakers and remove persistent troublemakers from the programme. That's instituting a witch hunt. And secondly, when it comes to Mr. Weisler, you stated to this committee before that he was respected as a whistleblower. No, he wasn't. Under your watch, he was blackballed and didn't work for the BBC again. Do you owe Mr. Weisler an apology?
Let me explain the circumstances.
No. Do you have a visa? Apology.
No, I'm not. I'm going to explain the circumstances. And the circumstances, as I've already said, are that, and this is, I have to repeat that my understanding comes from a forensic reading of the documents. No memory whatsoever of what happened at the time. But when I talk about him being respected as a whistleblower, I've already, you can see from the documentation that Tim Garden did respect him as a whistleblower, and that was the reason for my reference. So you have to ask Lord Hall why he used the language he did. My reading of
why did you allow the language to be used?
Hang on, please let
me... Order. You're not answering the question at all, and the point is...
I am answering the question.
Look. You stated these respect to the whistleblower. Now, you say that's with Mr. Garnham, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, we can accept that. However,
No. You
received a document. You have read this document. It is a you say to yourself it's a forensic document. You have read it. You have no personal recollection of the time. You have read that document. Now, what do you think, as an individual who was in charge of the BBC at this point, when your subordinate comes to you and basically says, well, I'll tell you what, the person who leaked that story, we're going to fire them. We're going to get rid of them. You think that's acceptable for you to have green-lighted that, or at least to have stood idly by? Is that acceptable?
Well, you put your finger on the issue, but honestly, this is a matter you should discuss with Lord Hall, because as I keep saying, I was not involved in the detail of this. But if you read the documents, it is clear that everybody involved, starting with Steve Hewlett, believed that there was a massive problem of leaking on the Panorama team, which Steve Hewlett addressed, the documents tell you Steve Hewlett addresses this with the team, and Sloman is obviously very concerned about it. Tony Hall is indignant about it. And I'm not in a position to tell you why exactly they included Matt Fiesler in that. But plainly, they were thinking about him as a leaker, not as a whistleblower, because the record is clear that he was respected as a whistleblower.
Yeah, well, what organisation respected him as a whistleblower? However, the person who's conducted this inquiry referred to him as a leaker and wanted to get rid of him. I return to my first question to yourself, Lord Burt. Do you owe Mr. Fiesler an apology, as you were Director General, when it came across your desk that he basically should lose his job for, as you say, being a whistleblower? Do you owe an apology?
I'm not in a position to... I don't understand enough of what happened and what Tony Hall and Anne Sloman knew to be sure about that. What I do completely recognise is that his value as a whistleblower, if he had not come forward, as I said earlier, I doubt very much we would know anything about this matter.
But you wouldn't have been able to down the matter, would you?
As a whistleblower and not qualified to know why Anne Sloman and Tony Hall took a different view.
Look, so you're not going to measure... I'm sorry, Mr. Fiesler, we were wrong all those years ago to effectively blackball you.
I don't know enough about it.
Well, it's there in black and white. You said you had the documents. It's there in black and white. Is that he's fired.
No, there is nothing in the documents which tells you about who Steve Hewlett and Sloman and Tony Hall thought were leaking improperly.
Okay, the final point concerns actions of those who leaked material to the press. We are taking steps to ensure that the graphic designer involved, Matthew Fiesler, will not work for the BBC again. Those sentences are concurrent. Is it just by accident that they're together then? Is that what you're saying? Because the truth of the matter is that they are pointing the finger at him as the leaker, and then they are saying he's going to be fired. And you saw that document, and you effectively approved that course of action, either by saying that it was the right thing to do, or by just sitting on your hands. So what is it?
As did everybody else who saw it.
Well, you were the Director General. You were the Director General, and you instituted a report.
Please let me finish. The whole of the Board of Governors saw it, the whole of the Board of Management saw it, and they trusted Tony Hall and Anne Sloman to have made a measured judgment. I don't know what that measured judgment was, but it's come up over and over again in this inquiry. You have to respect and trust the people that work for you. And,
well, does that include firing them? Does that include firing them, like Mr. Fiesler? Or is it only the people...
I,
to you.
We can usefully go round this circuit again, yeah. Chair. I've said all that.
Look, I just think perhaps just in this dark episode, perhaps just have the guts to say sorry to someone who's basically had their career ruined because they chose to do the right thing. Maybe that's just forgive me for saying so, but maybe that's just what you want to do.
I don't know how many times I can say it. I don't have enough evidence.
John Nicholson.
Why Tony Hall and Anne Sloman said that.
John Nicholson.
Thank you, Chair. Lord Burt, your hallmark, if you'll forgive the expression, was and always has been rigorous, fact-based, analytical journalism of the Brian Walden school. It must therefore be gutting for you that the biggest scoop of your period as editor-in-chief was secured through deception.
It is.
And, of course, it shows a failure of the editorial processes that you established.
Thanks. It does. It shows a weakness in them. As I'm sure you are aware, I established a whole set of processes that had not previously existed in the BBC.
But I was there. I remember.
And I'm sure you were highly compliant with them. But of course, the processes did not capture a rogue reporter and a serial cunning palace liar operating on this scale. And
which is precisely why, of course, we have to rely on senior management to be astute enough to see past scoundrels. Yeah. Because as journalists, you shake your head, but as journalists, all of us have come across... Let me finish the question, Robert. All of us as journalists have come across people who are dishonest. It's part of the process of journalism to ask the right questions to establish the truth. Now, we know that you were kept closely in touch with the Diana interview preparation. So when Tim Garden wrote his March 1996 memo to Tony Hall saying that Martin Bashir had lied, were you shocked?
I, as I've already made clear, I was shocked when I read Tim Garden's report, but that was only a matter of a few weeks or months ago. It came as a complete surprise to me.
So Tony Hall didn't run that vitally important report past you?
I can't find enough ways to say no. And
Presumably that's the reason that you wrote to a Member of Parliament, John Garrett, MP. I have the letter here in front of me. And you said to him, to Mr. Garrett, these allegations were thoroughly investigated by the BBC, promptly and thoroughly looked into. The BBC has been able independently to verify that the documents were put to no use, which had any bearing directly or indirectly on the Panorama interview. And of course, that was false.
It was false, but it was believed. And I can't say enough times that the simple conclusions of Lord Hall's report were accepted as the truth. And they were accepted, by the way, by the corporate centre of the BBC. Now, I signed that letter, but you will understand how large organisations work. There were hundreds of letters a day came into the Director General's office. So that letter would have been, and indeed you'll see, it was copied to the BBC's legal advisor. It would have been drafted by a unit at the BBC, and it was their honest understanding of the conclusions of Lord Hall's report. There's absolutely no way in which anybody was trying to cover up or mislead. That was their best understanding of the situation.
Did you make any independent effort yourself to try and establish the truth about Martin Bashir when Tony Hall had told you that he was an honest and honourable man, or did you simply accept what Tony Hall had told you?
I did accept what he told me, and for all the reasons I keep saying. It wasn't just Tony, it was Anne Sloman and Tim Garden and Tim Souter and Steve Hewlett.
Yeah, but you see, the thing is that both you and Lord Hall keep talking about how the BBC is a large organisation and how it's very decentralised. But of course, you reversed a lot of that when it came to journalism, because you and your team micromanaged. I remember standing in BBC corridors with my editor's boss asking me to keep a close eye on my editor
to make sure that my editor upheld journalistic standards. Yep. So there was a whole process that went up.
Absolutely.
You reversed the whole, what you saw as the woolly procedures that went before. What surprises me about all of this is you've got this very hot potato. You've got very good intelligence information. Your passion, of course, is news. And all of us who are around the BBC at the time, just remember how many stories were circulating about Martin Bashir's methods. Are you saying you heard none of this, despite your passion for news and your close knowledge of all the players?
Well, you kindly characterise my outlook, and correctly. I did have a very strong belief in rigorous, impartial, fair journalism. I was completely unforgiving of anybody who was not trying to uphold those standards.
Okay, so did you pick up the phone and do any fact-checking independently yourself as editor-in-chief?
Honestly, we're going around the same course.
What we're doing is we're pursuing the point. I want to know, apart from delegating to all these other people, and we're talking about, for instance, Steve Hewlett, who's now dead. We can't ask him any questions. We can ask you questions. I want to know if you picked up the phone to do any independent fact checking. I think you're telling me you didn't. So looking back, with the knowledge that you could have had then, and that you do have now, do you think Tony Hall was just incompetent, or that he deliberately misled you?
Well, I'm not willing to talk about a colleague that I worked with over a very long period of time, for whom I have the highest regard and trust. There's no way that I believe that Tony Hall knowingly did anything wrong. I'm sure.
And yet he didn't tell you about, you've just confirmed that he didn't tell you about this vitally important Tim Gardam document, which showed that Martin Bashir had lied 3 times. Now, that is clearly something that he should have told you about.
Well, I think that is something that you have to ask Tony Hall.
Well, I can't, because we just finished the interview with him, so you know I can't ask him about it. So that's one of these things that politicians quite often say, you'll have to ask X. I'm wanting to ask you, because you're here, do you think that he should have told you about the Tim Gardam document?
Well, I would like to understand why he and Anne Sloman didn't not only unveil that, but understand why they took the view that it wasn't worth reporting on. I did discuss, I think, this with Lord Dyson, and I do wonder, given Martin Bashir's skill, I have hypothesized and surmised, because I don't think anybody can remember the answer to your question, but I've surmised myself that I doubt very much that Martin Bashir put his hands up and said, I'm a complete compulsive liar and I've made the whole thing up. My suspicion... Please let me finish.
He actually acknowledge that he lied. Eventually, he acknowledged that he lied.
Yeah, but I didn't know about that.
You didn't know about it because Tony Hall didn't tell you about it.
I'm sure Tony Hall dealt with this, and Anne Sloman dealt with this. My suspicion is that Martin Bashir had a good explanation as to why he hadn't told them the truth. Like, for instance, his sources on them, I simply don't know.
Well, it's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? You've got this landmark documentary. It's getting headlines all around the world. Tony Hall, who is your protege, senior figure, Tony Hall knows that the person who made it has lied, has acknowledged lying 3 times, has been reprimanded in a BBC management letter for lying, and he doesn't think to mention that to you as the editor-in-chief. That's clearly a dereliction of duty.
Unless there's a good reason for it.
What would that reason be?
Well, I've already said he may have decided, he and Anne Sloman may have decided that that the kind of lie, in inverted commas, that Martin Bashir gave a satisfactory explanation. Like, for instance, He didn't, at that stage, want to reveal that Earl Spencer had opened the bank statements of his head of security. For instance, that is a complete, surmise.
Or he may just have wanted to cover it up. It all sounds very convenient, but fortuitously, Lord Burke, both you and Lord Hall are in the House of Lords together now, so I'm sure you'll have plenty of opportunities in the future to chat about this on the red benches. Of course, there's a third option, isn't there? Which is, we've mentioned your boss, Marmaduke Hussey, who is the BBC chair. Now, of course, we know that he was furious that you'd kept him in the dark about the Dana interview, and he's got hire and fire powers. Yeah. And your quote was on a shootly peg on this, and your job was on the line. Hiding the Dana interview was bad enough, I imagine, for Marmaduke Hussey, but having secured it on the basis of a fraudulent set of documents, now that might have meant curtains to you, for you.
I've already said that I told my wife at the time that I expected to lose my job as a result of agreeing to the interview, but I hope you're not suggesting, Mr. Nicholson, that I knew about the lies and failed to reveal them, because that is simply not true. And if you look at the documents that reached me, the governors and the board, you will see clearly that there was no reference to the lies in them.
Perhaps Tony Hall was protecting you by not telling you.
Well, as I'm afraid I've said more than once, you have to ask Tony Hall about that.
Can't ask him. We've just finished interviewing him. And I think on the basis of today, he's unlikely to come back again in a hurry. Do you know where the Gardam, this important Gardam memo, do you have any idea? Tony Hall doesn't, we sent to Tony Hall, he lost it somewhere along the line, it disappeared. Do you have any idea?
I have no idea at all. I knew nothing of it until I read it after Lord Dyson's inquiry started, and as I've already said, it came as a great surprise to me.
And you've heard no rumours about it since?
We've all had to keep to ourselves under the terms of Lord Dyson's inquiry, and no doubt I shall be going out into the world and talking to those involved, and I may learn more than I know now.
Thank goodness Tim Gardam, the author of it, kept a copy of it. Because if he hadn't kept a copy of it, given it seems to have fallen down the back of a sofa at the BBC, if he hadn't done so, none of us would have known about it. The inquiry would never have been able to come up with the substantive findings that he did, and journalism would have been ill-served as a result.
I agree.
Back to you, Chair.
Thank you. Damien Green.
Thank you, Chair. The BBC has accepted Lord Dyson's findings and report in full. Do you share that view? Do you think everything in it should be, as it were, taken as gospel?
I think Lord Dyson has done an absolutely invaluable job 25 years on of assembling and testing and challenging the evidence. And what I said at the beginning of this session, I could not have given you that account were it not for what Lord Dyson has uncovered. But as I've already said, and Lord Dyson reports this very fairly in his reports, he and I disagreed on the basis of the evidence that I've seen with some of his conclusions, and he reports that.
He does. But wait, so just to elaborate, which of his conclusions do you not agree with?
He and I discussed the issue which we have already discussed exhaustively, which is whether there was sufficient information to go to Earl Spencer. And as we again discussed, why didn't people go to Earl Spencer? Because they falsely believed Martin Bashir's account that Earl Spencer was the essential author of the document with supplementary information coming from Princess Diana. And I thought that Lord Spencer gave insufficient information, emphasis to what Tony Hall and Anne Sloman and the others believed at the time. His second area which he and I disagreed on and again, this has surfaced at the committee, was that he suggested that Anne Sloman and Tony Hall and others were too credulous, and I thought he gave insufficient weight to the things that I've discussed, which is the sheer scale of the deception that Martin, I don't think he put sufficient emphasis. He rightly and properly unveils the deception that Martin Bashir exercised in respect of Earl Spencer and Princess Diana. I don't think he put sufficient emphasis on the equally elaborate deception that Martin Bashir prepared to avoid detection from his BBC colleagues. And so, we can all discuss how a different group of people might have been more questioning, but I thought there were good reasons, which I've already rehearsed with the committee, why I think it was unfair to label them as being over credulous.
That gives rise to the whole issue of process, and in your exchanges with John Nicholson, we've already established that one of the things you were about to establish, Jeff, was trying to establish rigorous.
Yeah. Yeah.
And since it seems to me that the most useful thing about this session will be if we can explore
if
the BBC has changed enough, because the assertion is constantly made, this couldn't happen today.
Yeah.
And you're the world expert on sort of journalistic processes and things like that.
Yeah.
I'm still slightly hazy as to why it couldn't happen today. Particularly, I mean, you make the point that Martin Bashir may be a uniquely brilliant sort of fraudster and liar in the history of BBC journalism. I'm slightly skeptical about that. For all any of us knows, there may be someone like that making their way up the ranks of the BBC as we speak.
Yes.
What came? Why couldn't this happen again?
Well, I think it's a really good question, and I think it's extremely difficult to capture a fraudster, which is what he was. I have thought about this, and I can't give you any answer which I think is definitive, but I think the first thing I would say is, everybody has to learn from this, and I'm sure every editor in the BBC will already have learned from this. So the first thing is, and I don't know the answer to this, were there any warning signs? I mean, when you work closely with people, we've all worked closely with people, you find lots of subtle ways of understanding their character and their personal ethics. So the first question in my mind would be, were there warning signs about Martin Bashir, which I'm unaware of? And anybody in the future who sees warning signs about a lack of personal ethics in any colleagues has absolutely got to run up the flag. The second issue, and I think this arises from the reappointment of Martin Bashir as well, is due diligence. Now, I'm not sure this is reported about in this respect, but I work a great deal in the private sector, and all institutions develop over time, and institutional practice develops over time. And in well-run institutions now, people really due diligence anybody who's coming into a position of trust. I'm not sure this would have caught Martin Bashir, the so-called junior reporter who'd come from public eye, but plainly, to these days, into sensitive appointments, you've got to do the most, in the private sector, the scale of due diligence that's done on sensitive individuals is awesome. I think the third thing, which most went wrong here, is that he was allowed to act as a lone reporter, which I think was probably relatively unprecedented. But we can see why that happened, because his access to Princess Diana, and he controlled that access, and it created an aura over the whole episode. But no BBC reporter should work as a sole trader. And you have to have four eyes on the job, and I think making sure that happens, and from now on anybody's going to look for tougher standards of corroboration than we looked for 25 years ago. And the final thing I would say is we all have to learn from this, and I'm sure Tony Hall and Anne Sloman would agree with this. I expect them to agree with this. Is that I think where you're dealing with an issue of difficulty and sensitivity and complexity, it would be a jolly good idea to have a BBC lawyer on the team, because a lawyer just has a different cast of mind and thinks about things in a different way. And I think, I'm sure people in the BBC are thinking about this and thinking about the question you ask, how can we avoid it happening again? But they are some of the ways. I don't think this was a failure of governance. This was a failure of operation and having the right policies, as you suggest, underpinning operations.
And it sounds like what you're saying, just a final thought, that actually the reappointment was a worse mistake almost than the original appointment. I mean, it's classic, once more fool.
Yeah, well,
shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me.
Yeah, I think that in respect of, I mean, some of the reflections around his reappointment seem to assume that everybody knew what a crook he was in 1996. And as I've tried to make clear, that was not the case. And the mental model that I lived with for 25 years was not exposed. If anybody called me in 2016, I would have been giving them a very vanilla version of his role in this. But I agree. As is well known, I forbear to criticise this organisation in which I have the deepest possible belief. But I think the lesson for the modern BBC is they ought to have done much greater due diligence on Martin Bashir's subsequent career. We've discussed it before, particularly the disgusting things that he said about Sarah Palin and so on. And I think that there is a terrible irony in all of this, that he starts his BBC career on songs of praise and ends it as the BBC's religious editor, and in between perpetrates one of the biggest crimes in the history of broadcasting. I do question whether a proper due diligence would have unveiled the fact that he simply was not a fit and proper person to be the BBC's religious editor. But,
thank you. Back to you, Chair.
Thank you. Damien Hunt.
Thank you, Chairman. And just while we have you here, can I ask you something about something different, which is about the role and meaning of impartiality or due impartiality, as Ofcom reminds us technically is. I think most people acknowledge the BBC has a world view, and however stories are covered, there is always a choice of which stories you cover. Yeah. You now have new stations coming on stream with part of their mission being to hear from marginalised and overlooked voices. And for a number of years now, we've had radio stations with individual slots on them with more of a political hue. Lord Grade has spoken of the anomaly of the impartiality rules. I just wonder, from your long view perspective, how did we get here? And how do you interpret, or did you interpret, rules on impartiality at the time? I mean, when you were in office.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a really important question. And as Mr. Nicholson would tell you, this was an issue which I was particularly hot on. I would say that impartiality is a goal. I think that almost every journalist that works for the BBC, almost every editor who works for the BBC, has an understanding of it and does their level best to be impartial on the major matters of the day. But when I was directed, but it's a dynamic, it needs dynamic supervision. When I was Director General, there wouldn't be a day went by when I was watching or listening to our BBC output where I would not have seen opportunities to improve the BBC. And this is not because BBC journalists are wicked. We've talked about one who was deeply wicked, but there are genuinely testing issues around this, and it needs constant supervision to ensure that all sides of an argument are understood and rigorously tested. And if you ask me, did the BBC in my day always do that? It did it imperfectly. And as my wife would tell you, she has to hear me at breakfast or watching programmes at night and conducting the running commentary on how I can see opportunities to improve the BBC's journalism in exactly
we all
the same
get
way
that
I was ABC 25 years ago.
Thank you. Can I just ask you then, so when you see the emergence of these new formats, do you regard that as a welcome addition to diversity in media, or something that's just inevitable in the internet age, or as a failure of the BBC to reflect and hear from all voices?
Well, it depends what you mean. I mean, for instance, I have the highest regard for, I may not always agree with him, but I have the highest regard for Andrew Neil as a journalist. I think he's absolutely formidable. And I don't expect Mr. Nicholson liked his famous interview with Nicola Sturgeon. I mean, he is formidable. And I welcome a world where there is real diversity of journalism and where every perspective is tested. But let's face it, the BBC is one of the most cherished institutions, not just in the UK, but in the whole world. It has the most respected news brand in the whole world. And that is because, not because it always observes perfect impartiality, but because the whole world can see that it tries, that it is honest and decent. And, you know, this sad event that we're discussing today is a blot on that long and honourable tradition. But I hope will always be a role for a BBC, as we see in the pandemic, which is doing its level best to understand what's going on, parade that understanding, to test governments, to test opposition, so on. It is utterly invaluable part of our national landscape.
And finally, both you and Paul have spoken a lot about the issues around running a very large organisation. I think we all understand that being at the apex of such an organisation, you can't know everything that's going on. But in most organisations, there are some matters which would break through that complexity. And in particular, when we talk about something like the rehiring in this case, you would think that would be one. I just wonder, the number of times that you and Lord Hall had to plead the size of the organisation as a reason for what happened, I just wonder if you might now conclude it's just too big.
Well, I wouldn't conclude that because, as I've already said, I think this is an enormously valuable cultural asset for the country and indeed the world. And,
but it could be a number. It could be a number of slightly smaller, very valuable classes.
But what bits would you cut off? You know, the BBC Radio is in stunning condition at the moment. The television channels, its dedication to drama, to comedy. My wife and I have been watching Spring Watch. You know, nobody else in the world does anything wonderful as Spring Watch. Local journalism is in decline. Every night I watch the BBC's local journalism. I wouldn't cut any of that off. I passionately believe that the BBC needs to be supported and well funded. And let's face it, it's taken some mighty hits over the last 10 years. And I'm deeply concerned about its future.
There's a difference between broken off and broken up. I was asking about the size of the organisation, not whether all parts of current outputs had a role. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you very much. That concludes our second panel. Thank you very much for your evidence today, Lord Burt.